DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, deep and dirty in the worlds of science and technology as ever. I'm Zulfikar Abani, and coming up, as we enter the new age of HTML5, we're asking, why are some games developers turning away from the language of the web? We're also asking, where are Europe's tech micro multinationals?
These startups are very fast. They can respond to customer preferences in real time. They can source talent from around the globe. So the sky is the limit.
And get inside your digital memory. Confused? Don't be. Stay with us right here for Spectrum. But first, the global drug maker GlaxoSmithKline has just announced a $1 million prize to kickstart a relatively new area in medicine called electroceuticals, or bioelectrical medicine. Doesn't sound like a lot of money, but it is quite significant. If this makes you think of electroshock treatment, you're not far off, but the potential for actually curing people may be a little greater, and that for people with many more different types of illnesses than just in psychiatry. GSK says electroceuticals are its vision for the next 10 to 20 years. It's a move away from traditional drugs, the biological molecules that still dominate treatments today. And it's interesting, not least because it comes at a time when most of the major pharmaceuticals firms have been saying that drugs development, especially in the field of neurodegenerative illnesses, is too risky and too expensive for them to make a profit. So is this a new attempt to crack an old problem? And just what are electroceuticals? I asked Christopher Pham, the Vice President for bioelectronic research and development at GSK.
We think that the time has come when we can, with quite some precision, use electrical impulses to treat disease, to tap into the body's wiring of nerves that crisscross the body and control various organs, various functions, and ultimately therefore control various disease states. Up until this point, we have known that the nervous system has played that role, but the sort of the building blocks haven't quite been there to, in real time, modulate the signals that flow through that system. Now the technology is starting to be there, the biological understanding is starting to be there, but it's time to sort of put those pieces together and show that you can read those signals right into that system and treat disease.
So tell us in just a little bit more detail, what are electroceuticals or bioelectronic medicines? What are we actually talking about? What's happening?
Yeah, so we're talking about microscopic devices, if you will, that will connect to neural circuits, nerves, and with high precision change the signals that flow through those nerves and control individual organs or different biological functions. So, for example, you would have signals that flow to your spleen that controls the amount of inflammatory mediators that flow through the body. You would have signals that flow to your lungs that determine how tense your airways will be and therefore whether you have easy breathing or asthma. And the list goes on and on. There are all these signals that control various balances in your body.
You mentioned some of the areas of use, which illnesses, diseases we could be using electroceuticals. I'm wondering, though, how do electroceuticals differ from, let's say, traditional drugs or even electronics in a heart pacemaker or even, let's say, electroshock treatment? I mean, how can we differ?
Yeah, so let me start with how it differs from molecular medicines, so the sort of the normal medicines of today. And normal medicines of today are very specific in that they target specific molecular targets. But what happens typically is that they distribute throughout the body, so they have a systemic effect. And they're quite hard to calibrate. I mean, you need to take one dose, and that's what then your body will have to deal with. Electroceuticals will be different in that they target one specific neural circuit, in one specific intervention point, if you will, and there will change the signals in an adaptive way. So it will read the different states of the signals that are coming in and other signals from the body, and then modulate the neural what's called firing patterns, so the electrical impulses that flow through that point in the nerves. So what to take away from that is it's very specific in space, if you will, just in one point in the body. It's specific in time. It can switch on and off when it sees a disease signal. And it can adapt in a dynamic way to the patient. All those things are different to molecular medicines. And some of those things are also different to the sort of devices that you mentioned. So there are some neurostimulation devices today. Typically, they treat a much larger area of neural tissue, and in that sense is a more blunt. So it shows that electrical impulses work as treatments, but we feel that there's much more that can be gained through getting down to the cellular level where the actual signals are sent.
Well, what you're saying here does seem like to paint the general trend towards very targeted medicines, very targeted treatments. But what of the risks do you know so far? Because, I mean, a lot of people will think of electroshock treatment when they're thinking about having electronics change the way their bodies work.
Well, there are some risks in terms of whether we're going to be successful or not here, right? So will the measurements that we make in various model systems actually translate into treatments? How big difference do you have between patients? Those are some research risks that we will face here over the next few years. Ultimately, we need to be very careful when we go into human testing, just like we need to be with any molecular medicine, to establish first that these things are very safe at low doses, if you will, and then see what effect it has on disease. You are right that we are linking in to the nervous system here, so we need to establish very carefully what effect that has both on the end organ that the signals are sent to and the surrounding neural tissue.
Chris Pham, head of bioelectronic research and development at GlaxoSmithKline, on the line there from London. Now, when you go on the net, your web browser is constantly rendering web pages. Have you noticed that? Basically, the browser translates strings of instructions that tell it how a web page should look, including what text to display and where to put it, whether it's in plain text, bold or in italics, where to put the pictures, the links, video, audio, everything. And those instructions are written in a computer language called HTML, by whomever writes or runs or designs the site. You will have heard of HTML, even if you've never read it or seen it, and believe me, it's not very exciting to read, so you're not really missing much either. However, HTML does play a significant role in the way you experience the web and what you can do with it. It's hoped that the latest, still-developing version, HTML5, will help make multimedia functions uniform across operating systems and competing browsers. But notably, games developers are turning their backs on the new HTML. Chipona Chimbalu has been finding out why.
I'm playing FixPix. It's a puzzle game which makes use of the fact that you can tilt an iPhone. By tilting my iPhone, I can move the pieces around until they all fit together. And when I'm done with an image, I can even post it on Facebook. The trouble, though, is that my friends on Android and other devices can't play the game. That's because it's only designed to work natively on the iPhone. It doesn't work on other operating systems. Games developer Andrew Sin, who designed the app, says he had no choice but to design the app natively.
A native-built app is much more tailored to the actual hardware. That means it will perform better, it will feel more fluid.
HTML5 is a work in progress, but it already allows developers to create apps that work on all devices. And some of the changes, even those in recent months, are allowing developers to increase the speed of apps built in HTML5. Bruce Lawson, co-author of the book Introducing HTML5, says this new specification is creating an environment in which other elements, such as JavaScript, which is used within HTML5 to give you interactivity, can work better.
Well, we're seeing a lot of games using HTML5. We're finding that JavaScript, which is what you need to power HTML5 games, is ever faster across browsers now.
His view is shared by Nate Altschul, the founder of the HTML5 Games Meetup, a group for people interested in creating HTML5 games. He believes that HTML5 has had a lot of bad press in the past, especially since Facebook, which had once advocated the use of HTML5, decided to go native in iOS last year. According to Al Chu, a lot is changing for WebGL, the web graphics library, which also brings more interaction to HTML5, as he found out at the recent Games Developer Conference in San Francisco.
Most of those limitations are gone for casual games, so I think HTML5 is suitable for most casual 2D game types. I think the area where you'll still run into problems is with 3D games, but I was at GDC last week, and it looks like there have been some huge advancements in the area of WebGL, which basically enables 3D in the browser.
But app developer Andrew Sin is yet to be convinced about the changes. There's just some games that won't work in HTML5, like this game, Sonic Recall.
Like in the sound memory game, I have, if you find a couple of sounds that matches, then you have a flashing effect of colors, and that's an animation played back with 60 frames per second, so really, really fast. That's almost three times what you see in movie theaters in frame rate, and faster than the latest Hobbit movie that was praised for its high frame rate. And I think if you do that with HTML5, you enter problems with really getting fluid, fast animation effects in a game that make a game alive or feel fun or physical or something like this.
Perhaps the biggest strength that HTML5 has is that it is still being developed. According to Bruce Lawson, who also works for browser developer Opera, the aim of HTML5 is to allow people to develop apps that would work as though they were written specifically for a device.
HTML5 is not yet complete as a specification. Things are still being added to it.
Bruce Lawson and Nate Alchu believe that the fact that it is open and works across platforms should attract more developers, especially with the addition of new features. But Andrew Sin disagrees. Sin says he understands why some games developers who work with different programming languages for Android and Apple devices are unwilling to invest the time into developing and maintaining the HTML5 skills.
You have a learning curve. I mean, you can't just sit down and program an app. It takes a long time, and you have to get into that and see what you can achieve and kind of build up your abilities to make more complex games. People started out with iOS a long time ago, and like the Android developers, I think they're still kind of catching up with that, and HTML5 is like a new thing. So you first have to invest some research and see how things work, and I probably wouldn't really do that if I know how to do an iOS app.
HTML5 offers a lot of exciting new developments for both gaming and the web at large, but only developers can really make the call to use it or not. Bruce Lawson.
It largely depends on what you need. HTML5 isn't a monolithic thing. It's an umbrella term for lots and lots of different systems, different mechanisms. So, for example, if your app depends upon fast drawing of pictures on the screen, then that is complete. That's called Canvas, and that's been in all the browsers now for years, since IE9, for example. If you're looking at generating sound on the fly, then that is not yet complete as a specification and only experimentally implemented in a couple of browsers.
Given that developers have been working on HTML5 for a number of years now, and given that their work is far from complete, this is really a case where time will tell whether developers embrace HTML5.
Chiponda Chimbaru playing games while he works there. And you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani, on DW Online. We're at dw.de/spectrum. And you can, of course, follow us, as ever, at dw_SciTech.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
It's the startup Cinderella story that most web entrepreneurs could only dream of. Created by an internet-savvy teacher from his apartment in China, the online trading company Alibaba is now ready to take on the world. In fact, The Economist magazine recently estimated Alibaba's online transactions to have been worth 130 billion euro over the last year. That's more money than passed through Amazon and eBay combined. So as Alibaba prepares to take on the world, those with an eye on the success of European startups are asking a simple question. Why China? What does Alibaba have that European startups don't? Well, for a start, the company can rely on a very large market. In fact, China's online market is well on its way to becoming the world's largest. European startups, on the other hand, have to contend with a lack of a single digital market. They need to weave their way through different legal regimes and different languages of the EU's 27 member states. But there's more to it than that. There are those who argue that investors in Europe just don't get the online economy's business model. From Brussels, here's the second part of James Panicki's report on Europe's flagging startups.
Get what you need on your terms directly from manufacturers by using the world's largest online B2B marketplace, Alibaba.com.
Here's the lowdown. If Europe wants to be the home of the next Alibaba, it needs to get cracking. European Union member states need to take a sledgehammer to the bureaucratic barriers standing between tech startups and commercial success. And its investors need to embrace new models of business, ones which don't rely too heavily on immediate returns. Or that, at least, is the message coming from observers like Anne Mettler, the executive director of the Lisbon Council, a knowledge economy think tank based in Brussels.
There's a startup in San Francisco that was started by a Belgian entrepreneur, Xavier Damon. It's called Storify. And he tried for many years to get it off the ground here in Belgium. Never worked. He went to San Francisco. He teamed up with some other people. They got, I think, a $1 or $2 million investment from a very legendary investor. And I remember asking Xavier, it's like, what did you do? Did you write a business plan? And he said, forget about a business plan. The investor said, show me user adoption. So it's very much about getting people to use your product, even if you can't immediately commercialize that. This is a new kind of making money, a new business model that I don't think here in Europe we were very slow to understand, that giving something away for free doesn't mean you cannot make money off it eventually.
It's a business model which the bureaucrats in Brussels profess to be comfortable with. Here's European Commissioner for Research, Innovation and Science, Mary Gagan-Quinn, speaking last October at the launch of the Startup Europe initiative. That's a program designed to promote European startups.
We need to compete and win in cutting-edge sectors like nanotechnology, robotics, clean energy and life sciences. We need more medium-sized firms able to occupy top positions in niche markets. We need more young firms with high growth potential.
Yet convincing European governments that the future lies in the hands of smaller firms rather than the giants which have led the economy since World War II isn't always easy, particularly given that in tough economic times, the expenditure on innovation required to transform an economy can be seen as an unnecessary luxury. Yet Commissioner Gagan-Quinn argued that countries which have embraced innovation are now better able to weather the economic storm.
We've seen that countries like Germany and Singapore, who placed innovation at the centre of their economic policies, have been better able to weather the economic storm. And countries around the world know that their future depends on it. We had the arms race, we had the space race, now we have a global innovation race.
Now, the challenge for Europe is to embrace what are called micro-multinationals. That's right, the micro-multinational. It sounds like a contradiction in terms, but Anne Mettler, who has written a paper about the new landscape, says these companies are Europe's future.
A micro-multinational is a startup that is essentially a multinational from day one, thanks to digital technologies and particularly the internet. So if you think about how in the past multinationals have emerged, they were first based in a region in one country, then maybe they expanded nationally, then maybe, they expanded in Europe, and finally they went global. This process used to take years, if not decades. Today, you can trade across the globe essentially from day one. It's incredibly empowering for small companies, particularly very sort of web-savvy startups.
Would these companies companies be competing with more traditional companies in Europe, or would they be totally outside the current framework?
No, I think absolutely this is a competitive threat to large multinationals, because what you have to understand is these companies do not have the kind of legacies as big companies. Yes, you're a big company, but it also means you usually tend to be quite slow. It means you have perhaps hundreds of thousands of staff that you need to coordinate. These startups are very fast. They can, respond to new user customer preferences in real time. They can source talent from around the globe. The sky is the limit. So yes, this is a competitive threat to large, what we call macro multinationals in our paper.
So, providing European micro-multinationals with the right environment is now the challenge for legislators, both at an EU level and, more importantly, at the level of member governments, because those in the industry now argue that the next big thing to come from Europe may well be a micro-multinational. James Panicki for DW in Brussels.
Well, as Brussels has its eyes clamped on the future, in the UK, six major libraries are taking snapshots of the present. They've taken the first steps for a project that could become a precedent in Europe for how we archive our digital memories. New legislation known as Legal Deposit has made it possible for the British Library, the National Libraries of Scotland and of Wales, and three major university libraries to preserve and provide long-term access to the nation's cultural and intellectual output online. So that's every electronic publication, including blogs and ebooks, and the entire .UK web domain. It's a massive undertaking, but one that is arguably becoming more and more important as we spend more and more of our lives tangled up in the web. I spoke to Richard Gibby, the Legal Deposit Project Manager at the British Library in London.
Why are we doing this? It's really all about a legacy for the future, for our great-grandchildren and their great-grandchildren. I think many people probably know that the British Library collects a copy of every printed book, newspaper, magazine and journal, and has done so for many, many years. This is all about starting to collect the same kind of material in digital form. The printed collection that we have is a real treasure trove for our researchers and users at the moment. And in future, our great-grandchildren and their great-grandchildren really want to look back at how life was lived in the 2013, in the first part of the 21st century. And the digital content that we collect will provide a really vivid picture of that.
It's quite an amazing amount of stuff, though. I mean, we're talking about blogs, e-books, the entire web domain. How do you expect people to use this archive?
Well, it is. It's a huge amount of material. You're quite right. Just talking about .UK websites, which is where we will start, that's 4.8 million websites and over a billion pages. To give an idea of the scale, really, I think most people will know that the British Library has collected newspapers, all local, regional and national newspapers printed in the UK for nearly 300 years. That 300 years' worth of newspaper collection equates to about 750 million pages. And from this week, we're starting to collect over a billion pages every year from the web. So it's a huge undertaking.
And when you say you're going to start with the UK web domain, so what are your plans for the future? You're going to take a snap of the global domain?
Well, the legislation we have that came into being on the 6th of April entitles us only for UK-produced content. So, no, we will be focusing on UK content, but we will begin with .UK websites, and over time we will start identifying UK-published content in other web domains and websites, like .com and so on.
I imagine that there are a number of issues in this project concerning the technology itself and future-proofing that technology to make sure that this works. I mean, I remember when we started talking about CDs and DVDs, and actually we found out that they don't last forever. What are the issues that you are going to be facing in that area?
Well, you're quite right. Preservation is a really important aspect of this. This is why we have a partnership, really, between all six of the libraries involved. That's the British Library, the National Libraries of Wales and Scotland, and three major university libraries in the UK. We've invested, really, £3 million in a huge digital infrastructure to store all of this material. It will be stored in four nodes, So four times, four sort of sets of servers and storage systems hosted by the British Library in London and in West Yorkshire, by the National Library of Wales in Aberystwyth, and by the National Library of Scotland in Edinburgh. So that's four copies linked by secure network to ensure that if there is any chance of any damage to one of those copies, or anything happens, such as a flood or something were to happen to any one of those nodes, the material can be safely restored from any of the other three.
And just picking up on that word security, what are the risks of being hacked? I mean, if you're storing things like e-books, I'm sure that there'd be a number of hackers who'd be interested in that digital heritage to then sort of bootleg it.
Well, we've worked very, very closely with our publishing colleagues in this, and we have looked very carefully at the security of this and made a number of commitments and put very secure systems in place.
Such as what?
We have secure firewalls and secure network links between the systems and so on. And the material itself will only be accessible in the premises of the legal deposit libraries. The six libraries.
That's a very interesting point, because I did want to ask about the access. This is not going to be accessible by everybody, is it, in a sense, that we can just sort of log on somewhere and get access to this archive?
It won't be available online, no, but it certainly is accessible to anybody in that anybody can apply for a reader's pass at the British Library, and anybody can join the British Library for free and view the material for free in the premises of the library, in the same way that we provide access to our printed collections.
A lot of what is written online these days is purely for the here and the now. I mean, that's often the nature of the net in a way. I'm thinking about certain blogs or things on social media. Is that really going to be interesting to people down the line, sort of, you know, the rude tweets of a prominent teenager?
Everything that's published online will be of interest, I'm sure. It's ironic, perhaps it's interesting, really, to compare. In the Victorian era, many people, when the British Library began collecting newspapers, many people made the same comments at that stage. Newspapers at that time were seen as very temporary, transient material. Nobody really thought they would necessarily be of lasting value, but these days they really are a goldmine for researchers and for the general public who have interest in, you know, with their interest in social history. And I would say that the same applies now to much of the content that's published on the web. It really is of importance and value to people in future. It will become a treasure trove of information.
We still do have the issue of privacy and copyright on certain data. And I'd just like to sort of focus on the issue of the control of this data. You may be aware of Google's attempts now to sort of design an after-death policy. And I don't want to go into that in any detail at all, but I mean, what happens to people's content when they die? Say they do sign up to an after-death policy and they say, right, well, everything that's on my blog now is fine, and you take a snapshot of it, you hold it for a number of years, 50, 100 years, 200 years, but they've actually in the meantime died and they've wanted their content to be deleted. How are you going to stay on top of that?
Well, the importance of this is an archive, it's the permanence of the archive for the future. It's a record of history, so we certainly wish to preserve this material forever. In terms of copyright, the legislation is incredibly important because it gives us, the six libraries, that copyright permission to archive this content, and it also protects many individual website owners. Many people are very keen to have their content archived, but if their website includes any content from third parties without the benefit of this legislation, they would also have to kind of seek all sorts of copyright permission from the third parties. So this legislation is really important for them too.
Richard Gibby, Legal Deposit Libraries Project Manager at the British Library there in London. And that just about wraps up things on Spectrum on DW for another week. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. And listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Zulfi Karabani. Our studio tech was Gat Gyorgi. Join us again next time if you can. Until then, thanks for listening and bye for now.